Welcome to the Ecode News Report, your weekly environmental news show. My name is Tom Wheeler, the executive director of EPIC, and I'm joined with my friend Scott Greeson from Friends of the Yellow River.
Hey, Tom.
And Larry Glass of the North Coast Environmental Center.
Hello, Tom.
Jen Kalt of Humble Bay Keeper.
Hello.
And we have a very special guest, former EPIC executive director, first executive director in EPIC's history, I believe.
He's the vice president of policy and incentives at the Pacific Forest Trust.
Paul Mason.
Why, thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
Welcome back to Humble.
Welcome back to Humble. It's nice to see you.
Well, thank you. It's always like coming home.
So, Paul, just tell folks a little bit about your experience with Humboldt.
Sure, yeah. I went to Humboldt State back in the 90s. I ended up working at EPIC during the heyday of the Headwaters conflict.
The bad old days.
The bad old days. The very high-intensity, heady, ultimately successful or catastrophic, depending on how you look at it, era where we ended up with the Headwaters deal. So I was there from 1995 or so through the early 2000s, working at EPIC on Headwaters and then other subsequent largely forestry and endangered species issues. And as Tom alluded to, I did become the first executive director, transitioning into that little more formalized structure.
That makes three of the five of us in this room, so we've got a working majority.
And I think that that's three of six in EPIC's history, so we also have a majority there, too. So
well, at least a plurality.
Okay. Yeah,
so there was a long history prior to actually having any one person who would ultimately be responsible for whatever went wrong.
Leaderless resistance,
exactly.
I think we called it.
A much more flat management structure, we might say.
Right.
So after I left EPIC...
flat, at least. I don't know about management, but yeah.
I did a stint out in the Matol doing some restoration work with the Matol Salmon Group, which was fantastic. Somewhere in there, I got a call from the state director of the Sierra Club saying, hey, we're really looking for somebody to come to Sacramento and work with us representing on private land forest issues. It's like, wow, that sounds really interesting. Nope, I am absolutely fried. There's no way I want to do that right now. I'm going to go work with fish for a while. If you still have a job a year from now, call me back. And lo and behold, Bill Alio, the director at that point, called me back a year later and said, hey, we're still looking for somebody. I'm like, well, I could probably do that for a year. Go, you know, take one for the team, go to Sacramento, try and share some of what we learned and experienced here on the North Coast.
And two decades later...
So I ended up working with the Sierra Club for 7 or 8 years. Ended up as the deputy director of the Sierra Club California, which is the entity that represents all the chapters here in California. And then a little over a decade ago, I got the opportunity to move over to Pacific Forest Trust, where I've been ever since.
So tell us a little bit about Pacific Forest Trust.
So it's been an interesting evolution of my career in this work. Working at EPIC during the Headwaters conflict, which was very much, we're trying to stop bad things from happening in this fairly narrow context, dealing with Pacific Lumber Company and Charles Hurwitz and that whole saga. Might be time for a retrospective. It's been more than 20 years since that deal was even finalized.
If you're EPIC, we treat it like it was just yesterday.
Yeah.
So then the time working with Sierra Club was absolutely fascinating because that was representing the most influential environmental organization in Sacramento on forest and wildlife and a whole host of other issues in the legislature and in the governor's office and with the state agencies and really getting a much more nuanced understanding of how the politics work and what's feasible and how you actually get something done. One of the Sierra Club's core roles is similar to EPIC or Friends of the Eel or North Coast Environmental Center is stopping bad ideas from taking hold, things from happening.
The prevention defense. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, there's always stupid ideas being floated and somebody has to deal with that.
Right.
And that's an important role and I'm glad that they're doing that. It's frankly...
I hear a but coming.
But it's exhausting and it's not enough.
Well, the status quo trajectory is not where we need to be, not going to get us where we need to be in the future. We need to figure out how to affect positive change more quickly as well.
And that's really what we want to talk about ultimately here is how can we move fast enough to save the planet?
Right. And that's where I've been really thrilled to work with Pacific Forest Trust, because I think we've done amazing work in the context of forest and forest land management, recognize some of those values beyond just logs and real estate development to help make it more viable for private landowners to do better forestry, to recognize some of these other values and try and change the economic drivers. Because at the end of the day, you know, you might not like the economic realities and the outcomes of it, but they are what drives a lot of decision making.
So you're saying it's not just trying to convince landowners to be nicer to spotted owls and butterflies, but to actually give them a way to do that.
Exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, these are financial decisions, whether you're a private landowner trying to figure out how I'm going to send my kids to college, or if you're an institutional investor, which a lot of the large forest land tracts are owned by pension funds and stuff, and they have a fiduciary responsibility to their investors, they're not going to be subject to just a persuasion campaign of being nicer to owls and salmon, but how do we meet our financial obligations?
So how do you do that?
Well, we've come up with several ways to do that. Pacific Forest Trust was the key entity pushing to recognize that well-managed forest lands store more carbon than poorly managed forest lands. And if we create a mechanism where there is a financial reward for increasing carbon on the landscape and maintaining that carbon on the landscape, so that if you have a nice old well-stocked forest, that there would be a financial value to not cutting it down, that could be an important part of the financial math. And so PFT was the originator of the forest offset concept and helped create that and bring that into the regulatory framework. And at this point, that's a well-established mechanism that has made a lot of forest land that would otherwise be subject to more intensive harvest either give it a chance to rest, like the USAW forest that the Redwood Forest Foundation manages down near the Humboldt-Mendocino County line. That's a large forest carbon offset project.
That's basically the land between 101 and the coast south of the Mendocino line.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A large tract there that, frankly, was harvested extremely aggressively, almost vindictively, by Louisiana Pacific back in the day.
I think the technical term is cut to shreds.
Yeah. Savage logging practices there. And honestly, there's just not a lot of timber volume there. And the ability to let that land rest some and still be able to capture some income for not harvesting has been a key part of the business model for that property. And of course, that's being applied across the country for both small landowners and larger institutional investors.
What about the Van Eck Forest?
So the Van Eck Forest is actually a good example of another policy innovation that Pacific Forest Trust has been the driver of, and that's the Working Forest Conservation Easement that includes provisions that change management. So a lot of people are familiar with conservation easements in the context of we're going to prevent the development of this property. We're going to make sure you don't turn it into a vineyard or a subdivision or something. And that has historically been a key part of how conservation easements are used. A conservation easement is an agreement between a land trust and a private landowner to make certain commitments.
Basically, I give you money and you agree to give up the right to do something that you could otherwise do.
Correct. And it's all voluntary and it's all a negotiated arrangement. There's no arm twisting here. It's something you have to be comfortable with because right. It's a permanent commitment.
It's an agreement. Yeah.
Right. And this will run with the land long after you are dead.
Right.
So as we start thinking about how are we going to get back to forest structure that's going to take centuries, we need an instrument that's going to actually ensure land management that gets us in that direction over time. A common thing that we'll do in our conservation easements is require that you harvest less than growth until a certain percentage of your inventory is in trees larger than, let's say, 30 inches in diameter. So that we start getting some of those trees back on the landscape that, if you're managing for timber, you don't necessarily get to large trees. Because by the time you get to a tree that's a couple of feet in diameter, that's good enough for the mill. And a dollar now is better than a dollar and a half 20 years from now. So how do we start getting to that point where we're actually growing the large trees and down logs and snags and some of these other characteristics on the landscape? Well, conservation easement is a tool for getting there if you design them in a way that requires those characteristics.
So how's that all working?
Well, it's working great. The Van Eck Forest here north of Arcata, up around West Haven and Fieldbrook, you know, it's a couple thousand acres. It's actively managed timberland. We take a lot of volume of really nice redwood off of there while continuing to grow a larger, more well-stocked forest. If you look at it from the air, it's a striking difference from some of the managed landscape around that is managed in a different,
cough, green diamond.
A more historically industrial manner.
Yeah.
And so we're really growing a much larger forest there that has different habitat characteristics.
So I assume you're talking about selective harvest versus even age management?
In that case, it is, generally speaking, selective harvest there at the Van Eck Forest. Though we do a lot of conservation transactions with large industrial managers, largely over in the northern interior. Most of our larger projects over around Mount Shasta and northern Sierra.
The pine country.
Yeah, where they might be 15, 30,000 acre projects, and it's still industrial management. But for example, terms might be that you're leaving 10% of the volume in your clear cut post-harvest. Forest practice rules are getting it down to a 1 or 2% volume. Getting up to 10 or 15% is a significant difference over time and starts to create a little more structure on the landscape. Some of those broad approaches combined with more targeted conservation focal areas across a large landscape like that. Modest changes in some of these large acreages of industrially managed timberland can make a big difference for carbon and for wildlife. And honestly, those are the properties that are likely to be managed down to the regulatory minimums. So to the extent that we can make an improvement there, it may not be where you would like to get the management on your property, but it can be a significant improvement over what would happen otherwise.
If you're on the ground looking at these types of forests, the Van Eck Forest, for example, can have fairly well-developed native plant understory. You know, it looks like a forest. It's got different sizes of trees, which you call structure, as opposed to industrial management, where it's basically like you cut down all the corn in the field and then you plow it all up and you burn all the scraps and then you start over. The difference in the habitat in those two different types of management schemes is huge. It's not, as you said, it's not just about the trees themselves, but it's the habitat values, it's the water quality values, it's the not dousing the entire landscape with herbicides. The whole ecosystem is functioning in a much better way.
Right.
So I was going to talk about the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is Sierra Pacific Industries. Any opportunities to modify their behavior at all? Have you ever had any conversations with them?
I'll maybe take a step back and frame the whole question just a little bit differently. I mean, 15 years ago, industrial landowners were largely like, yeah, not really interested. We just like working on the forest practice rules. Everything's fine. You people are crazy. Over time, I think there's been a real recognition that this is a tool that helps them meet their business goals. The public's going to help pay for some of these changes in management. It gets to, they're not always bumping into whatever the landowner may be. You've got a little more distance between the regulatory floor and what you were going to be doing as your conservation floor. And it helps you make that transition to working in a more well-stocked, more mature forest. Because if you're managing land, you would rather be working with bigger, older trees. There's more value there. They're putting on growth faster. But economically, it's hard to get from the young forest you have today to that older forest because that time has a cost to the landowner. So if we can bring some public money in to help cover the cost of that time, then the landowner can then be managing a more lucrative, more robust forest in the future.
I brought up Sierra Pacific because I'm curious as if you'd had dialogue with them, because they've got to be back on their heels right now because they lost so much of their plantations to fire in the last 2 years. I mean, massive amounts of plantations just are gone now. So their whole model has kind of blown up.
Okay, and on the opposite end of the spectrum from SPI is the Arcata Community Forest, which has carbon sequestration credits that are going into managing that forest, and the McKay Tract Forest in Eureka that the county recently acquired, which will be modeled on some similar type of a community forest model.
Yeah, I mean, I think the McKay Tract falls into that category of two different ways you might want to be approaching conservation easements or acquisition type conservation. One would be directly around communities in ways that help buffer growth and sprawl and give people a place to recreate and a place to connect with nature. And that's a really important, valuable thing. But those are also frequently going to be the most expensive places to work. You know, you're not necessarily going to get the same conservation values in your neighborhood community forest as you are out in the more wildland areas on the sides of Mount Shasta where you're going to have wolves. You're less likely to have wolves in the McKay Track. That might cause some different levels of conflict.
They'd probably be moving out from Eureka into the McKay Track.
On this week's show, Paul Mason from Pacific Forest Trust talks to us about his work helping to create climate-adapted forests here in California.
So what we spend a lot of time on is really looking at the larger landscape. our focal area largely is built around the watersheds that flow into Shasta Reservoir and Oroville Reservoir. That's 7 million acres of Feather River, Pitt River, McLeod, Sacramento, and Upper Trinity. And looking across those areas that have just a disproportionate importance to the state's water system, and figuring out how do we work at scale here. If we're looking at 7 million acres across public and private land, 4 million acres of national forest, roughly 3 million acres of private land, that's a lot. And we're not going to do conservation easements on all of those. And that's not what a lot of these areas necessarily need as their first course of action. But how do we start prioritizing across these large areas where we can start thinking about conservation and restoration of forests and watersheds at a scale where it would actually make a difference to landscape level fire and watershed function? And how do we move on that quickly enough that it makes a difference on the same timeline that our climate is changing? Because that's the thing that has struck me the most in the last few years, is we're really starting to see climate effects manifesting differently in California. Fire is the one that's really on the top of everyone's mind, because the fire behavior and extent and loss and impact has gotten so much more extreme in the last few years. That's going to continue.
To put it mildly.
But that fire behavior is almost certainly linked to not just higher temperatures, but a more variable and more extreme hydrologic cycle. So we've had really serious drought in recent memory, and we're very likely to see it coming forward.
Correct. I think that this conversation gets oversimplified a lot.
Right.
You know, climate change is absolutely a driver in the sense that it is warmer, it's drier, the winds have begun to really shift, when we're getting precipitation is shifting, but the condition of the landscape is a huge factor as well.
Absolutely.
And it's one that I think gets glossed over too often, is you look back 200 years and we were dealing with a very different type of landscape. It was a much more mixed up, more big trees, openings in the forest, just more diversity in general.
A lot fewer freeways.
And due to past logging practices and fire suppression is an enormous impact. The forests look very different now than they did in the past.
Yeah, and any forest activist worth their salt will agree with you there that we've seen a catastrophic transformation of Western forests across the 20th century and now into the 21st.
Yeah, and frankly, I don't even trying to ascribe a value judgment to it. Like, yes, we cut down the forests of California. We built San Francisco a couple of times and all the other cities and railroads. And we built California on the backs of the forests a couple of times in many places.
Right.
That has changed the composition and the structure of these forests. And I think we need to recognize that the forest structure and the fire behavior in that structure has put us in an entirely different context now.
Well, we've added a lot of human beings to the mix, and we've got a vast road network through the forest, and that's where the majority of the fires start, is along the roadside.
Absolutely true.
Well, but what you're talking about essentially is, you know, there's the philosophy of try to protect everything that's still relatively intact, and then there's a philosophy of how do we manage things on a landscape level in a way that's accepting the fact that there's been all this massive ecological change, and what are we going to do? We can't turn back time. We can't just wish things were the way they were. They are the way they are now. And what are we going to do in the big picture rather than fighting over little scraps that are left?
Right. Well, how do we get back to a structure on the landscape and forest and other ecosystem types as well that is better adapted to fire being a really big obvious driver, but just other hydrology as
that's
well.
That's resilient.
Yeah, that's more resilient for climate. That in my mind is going to involve taking out a bunch of smaller trees in a lot of places and getting fire back on the landscape under the weather conditions that we like.
Right.
The thing that I find immensely ironic, and I make this point in Sacramento all the time in budget hearings in the Capitol, that we spend $1 billion a year on our fire department. We have an amazingly effective fire infrastructure at Cal Fire and the Office of Emergency Services and our local departments. We get 80% or 90% of the fires or more out before they get to 10 acres.
Right.
That is a state mandate, and we've executed on that really well.
With catastrophic consequences.
Right. How that actually manifests is that we are putting out all of the low-intensity fires really effectively and selecting for the most damaging fires.
That we can't stop.
Right. The only fires that are getting big to like a meaningful landscape size are the ones that are burning under extreme conditions, hot and dry and windy, and just having impacts on the landscape, like high mortality events for the forest and in many cases for people and structures and other
assets. The town of paradise.
Yeah, as well. And we need to change that. It's a really hard conversation because people get really jumpy about intentionally letting fire burn. It's easier to do it on public land, although the current...
It's not easy. Yeah.
And even then, it's hard to get there.
Yeah.
But we are going to need to shift our cultural acceptance, our societal acceptance of there is no scenario where we don't have fire. We can maybe control the timing and the impacts of that. So let's get more proactive about having it under conditions where we get beneficial outcomes. We cannot move fast enough on this. There has been a fairly effective conversation in Sacramento over the last few years about rebuilding a prescribed fire program at Cal Fire, and they've hired a lot of staff, and there's about 10 crews, and the hope is to get to 60,000 acres a year in the next few years, up from 3,000 or 4,000 a couple of years ago. There used to be a more robust program back before the recession 10 or 15 years ago. Even then, we were less than 100,000 acres a year.
But we're looking for millions
but
of acres a year.
We need to be in the millions of acres a year. I mean, historical numbers are that before European settlement, there was probably 4 or 5 million acres a year of fire in California. Mm-hmm. Granted, a lot of that's happening in places that are too populated for prescribed fire now, like Sacramento. But we still need to be getting back to having a lot of fire in the hundreds of thousands or millions of acres under conditions where we get stand improvement, landscape improvement outcomes, not catastrophes.
So all of this raises the even larger question of how do we move fast enough? You said, Paul, that there's no way we can move fast enough to get prescribed fire going. But the bigger question is how can we move fast enough, not just for California's forests, but for climate change generally and to protect enough of the remaining scraps of habitat Jen was talking about that we don't lose most of the species we're still fortunate enough to share the planet with. And one of the things we've been talking about in the last month or so is water policy and particularly Gavin Newsom's veto of SB1, a measure that would have retained the former standards for endangered species protection and water flows in the Sacramento Delta. And a lot of enviros are completely outraged by this move. But you had a reaction to it that I found at least interesting, illuminating.
Sure. As you said, there was an environmental priority for much of the last year to push Senate Bill 1, which was sometimes shorthanded as sort of Trump insurance, really right. Kind of making sure that there was a state legal backstop if there were any further erosion of federal environmental and worker rights laws. Gavin Newsom had been very clear that he had problems around the way some of those changes would affect the conversations happening in the Bay Delta, which are immensely complicated and not my area of expertise, so I don't really...
I've already ranted about them. Yes.
Yeah, without even having an opinion about that, the piece of all of this that I found the most interesting was that the governor said, I will veto this bill, but I don't want this bill on my desk. SB1 was carried by the president of the Senate, Senator Atkins from San Diego.
Thank you, Senator Atkins.
And she said, I'm putting this bill on your desk. I'm going to pass this through the Senate and the Assembly. And we haven't seen much of that in the last decade or so.
Right.
Under the Jerry Brown administration and for the most part under the Newsom administration, there has been a Democratic governor, Democratic majorities in both the Senate and Assembly. And it's been all very collegial and worked out behind the scenes. And we haven't seen much of this high profile conflict between the bodies. I found it really refreshing, honestly, to see the Senate say, no, we're a co-equal branch of government here. We're not going to just not take up a bill because the governor says, I'd rather not see this bill on my desk. We're going to go ahead and do this because we think it's important. I think that that's healthy from an overall health of our body politic. I think that having that tension is good.
Two of the big lessons I took from Jerry Brown's tenure in the governor's office were first that the immense power of that office, as you point out, they basically dictated not just what bills were signed into law, but even which bills got considered. And a lot of policy was really shaped early in the process by the governor's office saying, no, we're not going to do that. The other thing is just in a strange way, given Governor Brown's reputation, that the deep cautiousness, the conservatism of a lot of their policy approaches. I see that continuing, and I think we may have a difference of opinion about how the Newsom administration is approaching water policy in the Delta, but I see this basic trend continuing of a sort of let's protect above all the status quo and be careful about how we change it. There's some obvious reasons in politics to do that. You don't upset all the apple carts at once. Look what happened to Jimmy Carter when he said, hey, we need to reconsider Western water subsidies. That cost him a lot of the Senate immediately in his first term, which was dominated by Democrats in those days. But the classic formulation of policy is, in my memory, the idea that Max Weber put forward, that it's the slow boring of hard boards. It's really intense work. It takes a long time to get it right. But we face challenges that we don't have decades to deal with. We've got to move quickly. How do we do that in our system?
I've got an enormous amount of respect for Jerry Brown's, the dumpster fire that he walked into 9 years ago.
Yeah, and let's not forget that.
Yeah, with the budget in absolute disaster. I mean, the fact that he was as effective as he was in helping to put California back in the financially very solvent position that we are now can't be underestimated. And he, I think, came in a very different context, also very well seasoned, having, you know, his third and fourth terms as governor. And then we've rolled over into a new administration, the Newsom administration, which there's just a loss of momentum when a lot of people leave. You've got a bunch of new people coming in who can be very smart and competent, but it's all new.
I'm not sure they even have an agenda, though.
They have an agenda in certain places, and other places are still figuring it out. And unfortunately, I think that how do we address landscape resilience in a changing climate is one where they're still figuring that out and where we've been trying to help them figure it out. I mean, there's been a lot of focus on, okay, we can't let towns burn down like that. You know, we're going to really put resources into...
like Paradise?
Into protecting towns like Paradise. I mean, you saw in the Kincaid fire, they took an entirely different approach to dealing with that and said, okay, we know this is going to be an epic firestorm nightmare. Everyone out. We need to not be running around in the middle of the night trying to drag people out of their house. That is not the right way to do this.
And they pre-positioned a bunch of equipment and people, and that probably made the difference.
And as traumatizing as that whole event was for the people there, it could have been so much worse.
Yep.
And there's been a huge amount of focus on, I think, that side of the public safety and preparedness piece, because, you know, if you are sitting in the governor's office or in any of those roles, that public safety thing is your first, second, and third job. And I've heard that 100 times, that we're going to do that first. We know that the other broader landscape resilience is important, and we're working on it. And it's hard because you've got a gazillion different landowners and conflicting desires for what should be out there on the landscape. And we've only been here for 10 months. So that's kind of the context, broadly speaking. So the thing that I think is an essential part of the way forward is to look at relatively large landscapes and identify, you know, what's the condition we're trying to get to? Where are our current areas of, we need a priority intervention? We've got hundreds of thousands of acres of super dense, young, fire-prone plantations. What do we need to do there?
We're not going to turn it back into old growth.
Well, how do we at least reduce risk and get us on a trajectory towards a more resilient forest, both in the short and medium term and in the longer term in some of these areas?
Right.
But having a plan across significant watersheds, I mean, we focus in on that 7 million acres that flows into Oroville and Shasta. You know, you could just take the Feather River or the Upper Trinity or the Eel and say, okay, so where are our priority spots? What are we trying to get to? Can we have somewhat of a common vision? And how do we permit these activities in a vastly more efficient way? Because, like, you know, we do a lot of work in a landscape that used to have a lot of both wet and dry meadows that are extremely ecologically important, hydrologically important. Trying to do meadow restoration, the permitting is just, you know, you can spend years doing a permit for a 100-acre restoration project. We can't be moving that slowly. We need to figure out where do we actually agree that we need to be doing these activities that get to an ecologically beneficial outcome, and how do we make the good stuff easy? I'm a fan of trying to get to some of a larger, look at a large watershed, do some programmatic permitting where you're sort of, you're not getting down to a hyper level of detail in all of these, but at least there's a context for where are we trying to go. We're going to break a few eggs. Getting to the scale that we need to get to, we're going to see some projects happen that we're not thrilled about. I've just come to accept that we are not going to do 5 years of evaluation on every project. Hopefully we don't do too much damage along the way, but we need to be doing an awful lot more than what's going on right now. Just a regulatory problem.
But getting everybody at the table to agree on prescriptions ahead of time can save a lot of grief.
Absolutely. You end up with very different conversations on public land versus private land.
Right.
Very quickly you get beyond complaining about the regulations and realize, oh, wait, there's nowhere near enough loggers or haulers or other people to actually do this work. I mean, over in the northern interior where we do a lot of our work, that's a major problem. We've got some property outside of Yosemite that we were trying to do some work on for years, and just actually finding the infrastructure, the people,
the industry capacity is gone.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually become a really significant problem, and a lot of the work that would be most ecologically meaningful doesn't pay for itself.
Right.
Is the other rub here. So I don't want to leave with the impression that regulations are the big part of the problem because they're only a piece of the overall context. I think the bigger need is sort of a common vision of where we're trying to go so that we can then build some social license and some consensus around the types of projects that would be positive and help get us to that large scale where we can have ecological processes like fire happen to help maintain those conditions and get back to a more resilient landscape.
So what you're saying then, Paul, is without vision, the people will perish?
The place where I see the conflict happen most often is when there are lots of solutions proposed, you know, new exemptions or new ways to do things, but not a comprehensive plan or vision for where we're trying to go. I think that when we start having these conversations about, you know, we need to thin that forest, if it's not an abstract, but it's an actual place on the map that fits together into an overall vision for the landscape, you start to bring disparate entities together with a lot more common purpose.
In the Trinity Collaborative, we call that desired future conditions.
And not in a general way, but where we can actually identify where are our priority problem spots and how are we going to get there.
And that's a wrap. Thank you to our guest, Paul Mason from Pacific Forest Trust, for joining us on today's show. If you have any topics you want discussed on a future show, email me at tom@wildcalifornia.org.